Endless Hustle presented by the Movie Trivia Schmodown. The Movie Trivia Schmodown is the ultimate mental sport for the movie fanatic. Intense movie trivia with the flair of pro wrestling. Championship matches, competing factions, MDS has the best competitors in the world. This isn't your parents' game show. The end of the season finale is a Schmodown Spectacular Six. All of the championships on the line and all the greats play here. This isn't bar trivia, this is the Movie Trivia Schmodown. Hello, hello, hello. Happy post-Thanksgiving, Endless Hustlers. We're back from the holiday, and boy, do we have a loaded week for you. Episode 115 of Bro Bible's Endless Hustle. I am, as always, your host, Arthur Cade, and we have a great triple header ahead on this one. We're kicking this episode off with the first lady of Shark Tank, the one, the only, Barbara Corcoran. Of course, brand new season of Shark Tank. But Barbara has an incredible podcast called Business Unusual with Barbara Corcoran. We're talking all about her career, just an inspiring and incredible chat. You guys are going to love it. We then go into another incredibly savvy businesswoman and a woman who I think we can call the queen inventor of America. Forget queen or king, the inventor of America. A woman who had Jennifer Lawrence play her in a movie and get an Oscar nomination. And now she's the host of an incredible new show on USA called America's Big Deal. I'm talking, of course, about Joy Mangano, another just brilliant, brilliant chat. And then we're finishing up this great episode with one of the biggest reality stars on television, Lindsay Hubbard. She is a star of Bravo's Summer House, but also Bravo's new show, Winter House. Fantastic chat with Lindsay. She's such a fan favorite in New York. It's funny. I put up her picture and everybody in New York was like, I can't believe you interviewed Lindsay Hubbard. It's so hilarious. I mean, it's just not hilarious. It's hilarious in a great way. It's how popular Bravo reality stars are. But Lindsay was just such a fun chat. So let's kick this one off. We're jumping right in with Barbara Corcoran. Her podcast is called Business Unusual with Barbara Corcoran. And of course, Shark Tank. I think you guys are going to love this one. Here she is, Barbara Corcoran. We've got a great day on the Endless Hustle as I'm joined by a New York legend and now a TV legend, the one and only Barbara Corcoran, the queen of Shark Tank. Barbara, can you believe it? Another season of Shark Tank. This is a never-ending show. It's going to go on forever.
I think we're all going to die in our seats and they're going to replace us with young people, for sure.
I had Damon on the show and Kevin over the last 4 to 8 weeks, maybe 12 weeks, who knows, but those guys were a blast. And to see the chemistry that you guys have, the camaraderie, was that instantaneous? I mean, did this thing happen right away?
Not at all, because for the first year, Arthur, we were all scared. The only guy who wasn't scared the day he sat on the set, honestly, was Mark Cuban. He came in like a cocky son of a gun, and I don't think he's had a scary thought in his whole life. But for the rest of us, we were constantly called, telling us that the show wouldn't be continued, we wouldn't get enough episodes, you better plan on something else. So for the first couple of years, it was pretty damn choppy.
Of course, Cuban didn't care. He kept looking at his bank account every morning, and he thought, what do I have to worry about? Life is good, right?
Yeah, even on the show, I tell you the truth, I'm still astounded. Like somebody will come in and ask for like $800,000, will say, I'll take double the stock and I'll give you triple the price. And we're like, what? Did he do the math? I mean, the money almost at times feels meaningless. And I realize there's a real, really big difference between a billionaire and a millionaire, like night and day.
So I want to talk to you about your story because you have such an incredible and inspirational story. For those, I know you've spouted it many times, but for those who haven't heard it, your journey from essentially secretary and kind of down and out to becoming Barbara Corcoran is incredible. Do you kind of ever look back and think, how did I get here? This is all so surreal.
You know, it's not, it's very easy for me to remember. I was that diner waitress the very lucky night my first boyfriend walked in and became my business partner and gave me the $1,000 loan to start the business. So I can look back at those days of all those menial jobs and hustling, but it's kind of weird. I look back at them realizing I was very happy. If somebody hadn't walked in, I don't think I would have had the gumption to get out and start something on my own. It just happened to be a lucky break. And I thought even my attitude at that time was, hey, what the heck? I'll give it a whirl. I gave everything else a whirl. It was my 23rd job by that point. And so there's no big deal. It was kind of, give it a whack and see what happens. I was surprised and I'm still surprised. And I think back sometimes to those early days and thinking, wait, how did I get to be one person to 1,000 people? How did that happen over those 20 some odd years? Like, what were the key moves? And I could distinctly know in hindsight that the key moves was I had a good marketing head. I could grandstand anything, make something small look big. But I am almost having a hard time remembering what those steps were at that point that somehow got you from A to Z, because they were so steady and you were never in the moment when you were taking a step or making a decision. You were already in the next step, worried about the next step, worried about the next step. And before you knew it, 25 years had flown by and you had a big business. I don't know if I answered your question. Did I, Arthur? I'm not sure.
You did. And it's funny because I think about this all the time as a 43-year-old, now middle-aged man, which is bonkers to me because it feels like I was 21 yesterday. But yeah. You look back at the steps of your life and you realize how they all essentially accumulated to get you to where you were, even if you didn't realize at that moment that they were accumulating towards a common purpose. It's incredible.
Yeah. You know what it's similar to? It's almost like when you have kids and they grow up, you look back and you remember them as little, but you don't know what happened to that middle section that flew by and now they're all grown up and out of the house. You know, it goes by so fast and you lose that middle ground a bit, I think.
You are such an iconic New Yorker. And for those who either are transplants or New York natives, there's no city on the planet like New York. It's energy, it's electricity, it's innovation. It inspires all of us to be better. For you, what was your New York moment? What was the moment in your life where New York had this significant impact on you and helped change the direction of your life?
Truly, it was the first day I stepped foot in New York because I was walking on 86th Street. I distinctly remember it. I had gotten my first apartment with two roommates in the Village Voice. We're all sharing a one bedroom. And the first day I went, my first job wasn't real estate. It was a receptionist job at a small building company. But when I walked out the door, I passed the newsstand and I was friendly. I was from New Jersey. Hello, good morning, sir. You don't do that. You learn to stop that in New York right away if you're a young girl. But the very next day I walked past the same newsstand to say hello. It was a different newsstand, different product, and a different guy. And I was like, wait, did I imagine this? And I realized so clearly just on that one first impression, whoa, this city thrives on change. And I felt right away in my soul that there'd probably be room for me because I was a newcomer. It was a city where change can happen. And you know what? I found in short order, the city wasn't the kind of place that wanted to know who you were, where you're from. It was just, it didn't really give a damn about that. It just wanted to know what you could do. And not only what you could do, but what could you do for me now? You know, it was such a now city. And so I was caught up in the fever of New York. And in hindsight, I don't think I could have ever built my business in any city but New York. Not that I know all the cities, but when I visit cities around the states, at least, I can't imagine having found a city that was more suitable for me, that welcomes everybody into a situation where the newcomer is welcomed, actually. And the other great impression I had, which gave me almost like a self-power or like a tease or an excitement that, oh, I might be able to do this. I might be able to accomplish this dream I have for myself, was a year into the business when I walked into the Real Estate Board of New York to meet my peers. And I walked into 60 guys in expensive suits and shoes, all looking alike, all the sons or grandsons of the wealthy guys in New York who own the real estate club. And when I looked and how they dismissed me and how they didn't even notice me, I realized they're not going to take me seriously. Wait till I show them. And it beefed me up versus put me down because I realized they were ripe for picking. Because, you know, the big guys go to sleep on the wheel and they're not watching behind their back. A little guy's a scrapper, you know, like, who's going to get me? Who's going to get me? And I realized I had the advantage of coming from a poor background and they had the disadvantage of having assumed a lot that was supporting them and thinking that it would be there forever. But it's so easy to knock out a big guy if you're scrappy. You know, you just got to bite at his heels again and again and again every day of your life. And they're not watching you. They started watching when I was their rival, but it was too late, you know?
It's funny you mentioned the scrappiness because I think that's what is so special about New York. Obviously, when you watch television, you see the glamour and the almost dynasty-like culture that we can see on the Upper East Side or in the West Village.
All
but
true.
At the end of the day, transplants like you and I, what unites us is the scrappiness mm-hmm. of the city.
Mm-hmm. It's also, by the way, what annoys people about New Yorkers. God, they're so rude. They're so pushy. They're so fast. They walk too fast. I hear that all the time from visitors that come to the city and stay with me. So it's the good and the bad. You know, it isn't always the friendliest, warmest place in the world, but it sure lets you know what you're made of. No doubt about it. You have no choice. You've got to compete. If you're not a competitor, you kind of step to the side, sadly, in the city.
Was there ever a moment, Barbara, that you walked by that newsstand after you had quote unquote made it and thought, transplant Barbara to I made it Barbara and the world in between?
Honestly, I wasn't that romantic. No, I walked by a million newsstands. I'd never even crossed my mind. I'll try to think of it today, actually, down the corner. No, because I was so busy living in the future, what the next step, the next battle, the next obstacle, the next issue, the next personnel problem, the next recruiting problem, the next foreign language somebody had to teach or learn or whatever. To keep up with the ever-changing New York City landscape, I was too self-focused on what the business needed, you know, who that business had to be, what complexity did it have, how it was going to answer the needs of things that changed on a dime, you know, prices dropping, shooting up, people leaving, swearing they'd never be back again, you know, all that crap that goes on and on in this changing city. So that kept me so busy with my mind and body on tomorrow that I think it's a lacking in me to size something up and look back at something. You know, it's just like, what's new? Not what was, but well, hey, what's new? What's coming at us?
Where did the switch change? Where did it go from on to off where you realized, okay, I'm not just an average person. I really am an entrepreneur. I'm driven and I can build what ended up becoming a multi-million dollar business. When was that moment that the switch just changed for you?
I'd like to say it was a switch, Arthur, and I could tell you the day and the moment and the hour. It really wasn't. It was being aware in hiring salespeople, especially superstar salespeople, who had traits that made them phenomenally successful that I then afterwards recognized in myself. You know, for the first 2 years, I was a rental agent renting apartments, opening doors, running around. I thought my success, honestly, was based on my nice personality. People liked me. They trusted me, maybe because I looked a little wet behind the ears from New Jersey and I didn't look like a hard New Yorker. And so people trusted me and I did well renting apartments. But it wasn't until I had to groom and then later recruit the key salespeople out of the competitive firms that I started to recognize what they all had in common, which were they were all ambitious. You can't teach someone ambition. I don't even think you could teach a kid, maybe help them along. But, you know, some kids in a family are aggressive and some kids aren't. You know, some kids are softer and more loving and some kids aren't. And so I noticed that each of them that had that trait of ambition, they were each, whether they were born that way or groomed themselves that way, but they were competitive, sickly competitive. And what they also had, I noticed, is when they lost a deal, a bigger deal than anybody else in the office, something they put more time in and more effort in than anybody else in the office, they took it hard, just like everybody in the office did. But their ability to feel sorry for themselves for just a minute or two and brush themselves off and get back out there was remarkable. They had that bounce back ability. It was a faster speed, a jollier ball, you know, that kept bouncing. And so in hiring these people and nurturing them and supporting them and trying to get more and more of them in a sales organization, which is the bloodline of the organization, I started realizing they're all like me. And I'm like, I'm ambitious, I'm competitive, I'm good at bouncing back. And then I started seeing that those were my great traits just as they were in them. And so I think it wasn't a moment, but a gradual learning of kind of like how I was wired. You know, I was too busy looking out, so I couldn't reflect in so much.
Yeah. How important did failure play a role in your life? The constant failure, the constant no's, the constant rejection. How important is that in terms of success?
Well, the important failure happens when you're a kid, not as an adult. By the time I was an adult, I was getting pretty good at that. I expected it. There's something about expecting failure that takes a lot of the bite out of it, right? But as a kid, you're a clean slate. you're tender of heart, you're forming your impression of everything in life. And so my great advantage at the time, it was terrible. Of course, I wouldn't wish it on any kid. But at the time, as a kid, being such a stupid student, just because I couldn't learn to read, I mean, if I had been able to unlock how to read, I mean, a reading is, the front door to all knowledge when it comes to school, not on the street, but when it comes to school. So if you can't read, you can't succeed at school in any subject. Reading is essential. So for me, I didn't learn to start to read till I was in seventh grade because I just had a brain wired that way. It wasn't through want of effort, but by third grade, I gave up. I hated the school. I hated the nuns. I hated the report card. I would change my marks, even though my father would sign them. He knew I changed them. He just let me off easy after a while, you know? But the school failure was so damaging to my psyche that I'll never get over it. I mean, I've gotten over 80% of it, but put me in a stress situation where I'm not confident, where I'm not overprepared, where people are looking at me, where I'm supposed to be the expert, and I'm not sure I'm the expert on that subject, and yet I'm asked to speak on it, I go right back to being in second grade, panicked to death. So you never really kill those old voices or ghosts in your head, I don't think. But what's great about it and why I'm thankful for it is by the time I got in seventh grade, I already had my first job because I needed, well, thanks to my mother, she pushed me. I had a lifeguard kiddie pool job, right? But she pushed me into another form where I could perform. And what I was good at is not reading, but I was good with my mouth. So I could talk to people, make everybody happy. And I started making my living right through high school and into college all the time. I had one, usually two jobs in college, but I was good at all of them because people liked me and I was on my feet and I was fast and I was efficient. So I discovered my better self. But thank God I had that background because without it, I don't think I would have become a big success. I wouldn't have had the hunger to prove to the world that I am not stupid. And I really still have those moments on Shark Tank where I'm sick to my stomach, feeling like I'm not performing well, I'm not saying the right thing. I've been too quiet. I can't be heard. My voice isn't powerful enough. And all that panic starts. And it takes quite a bit to knock some brains back into my head and remind myself I'm past that. And probably what I have to say is going to be good enough, you know, but it pushes me to perform all the time, like a neediness. I of course, if I employed a good shrink, I could straighten all this mess out, but I don't because I'm too cheap to spend money on it. And I don't want to tell people my shrink and I were talking, you know, but that was the best background looking back, but the worst background as it happened. I got paid well for it is what I'm saying. I got paid well. It was worth it.
You famously sold your company for $66 million. At what point did you realize that you were going to sell your company? When did you feel it was right? Because I would imagine that your company was your baby. It was something you'd built from the ground up. You'd nurtured it. You had built it. And then there comes a point where you say, okay, I can cash out. What was the decision-making back then where you realized this was what I need to do?
You know, it wasn't that calculated, honestly. I had had my first baby when I was 46. I couldn't have a baby, and I had 7 years of in vitro. When Tommy was finally born, I had him as 1, 2, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, I guess. I was so drawn and quartered in my business. I had my star salespeople demanding my attention at 6:30 in the morning. And I had my son when he was first born wanting me to nurse him. I mean, it was weird. It was like, who is this person? I had sibling rivalry play out in my heart every day of the week between my business and my own children. Then I subsequently had a daughter 10 years after that, but it was tough. I wanted to be the super mom at work. I knew I was. I adored everybody who worked for me. Well, with a few exceptions, quite honestly. And with a few exceptions, they all adored me. Okay. And I wanted that to continue. And I was already the number one real estate company in the residential space. And that's the night when I realized that clear as a button that I'll sell this thing. And I sold it right away. It was not any more thought than that. It was the first year I had made money. Think about that. I worked my whole life. I always made less money than the least paid person in the company because I plowed it back into the business as we all do. But 1 year, accidentally, I had over $1 million left. I'm like, $1 million? How did we not spend that on something, you know? And in realizing that, I said, this thing must be worth something. You know, we had 1,000 people. We had the number one spot because my partner and I, the night before, were doing our usual monthly body count, which went like this. It was no MLS, so you had no idea who had control of the market. But we went through every company's listing by price category, by size category, massive charts by hand. One night a quarter, and we put all the numbers. And that one night we looked, and I said to Esther, look, we're number one, straight from the top to the bottom on all sizes, east side, west side. You know, downtown was just developed for about 5 years at that point, downtown for what it was. And I said, let's sell this place. And she goes, okay. And we sold it. And it was a fast sale. I mean, we had an offer initially. I was on a ski chair with my brother, John, the roofer from my whole hometown. And I said, John, look, I just got a $22 million offer for the company. He goes, my brother, John, talks like I talked when I was in New York. Good job, Bobs. You think they'll really give you the cash? That kind of thing. And I said, I think they will, but I'm going to ask them for 66. And that's what they ultimately paid. Why are you going to ask them for 66? Because it's my lucky number. Good idea, Barb. Luck is luck. And that's how we sold the business. It didn't take any advanced thinking or analytics or anything smart. And I should have probably hired somebody from Harvard right away to do an analysis. But it wasn't about that. It was time. I didn't want that. I didn't want the competition in my heart every day of my life. It just seemed like the right time. Yeah.
So when that happens and you realize you're quote unquote rich at that point, and rich means different things to different people, but that's a pretty extensive amount of money. What was
for
your
me,
mindset?
It was.
Yeah. It's a huge amount of money, but were you kind of like, what's next? Or was it the opposite? Was it like, I'm ready for a breather and I want to enjoy my family and my life at the moment?
Well, I wanted to have more latitude with my son and be more present with him. It wasn't like I didn't pick him up after school at 3:30 every day and walk him to school. I did. But what was on my mind from 3:30 until 7:30 was all the stuff I didn't get done, you know, not the healthiest way to live, like not being in your shoes, so to speak. So I wanted, that was my, the dragon I wanted to slay. And I did right away. I had nothing else to work on. Like, what was I going to think about? So he had too many clothes, too many colors. I focused on dressing him well, a very important thing, making a few dinners. And within 3 months, I realized I had to do something. I kind of pictured myself better at leisure than I could ever be. My leisure to a large degree is creativity. And when you have a business, what's beautiful about it, if you're a marketing type person, is you have a giant blackboard. You can put up there whatever you want. You think of it on a Monday, get out on the streets on Wednesday. At home, what was I going to do? Learn to make another casserole. Somehow it felt a little quiet and mundane. And so I knew in short order, I had to change my life and become somebody else. But what to become wasn't so easy. And for the first 3 years, trying to choose to be a real estate personality in the media space was easy enough from the outside, I guess it would look, but it was not easy actually doing it. Because everyone wanted to meet me in the TV world, but they wanted to meet me to ask me what I thought their house was worth. It always was the last question. Oh, by the way, one last question, you know, what do you think my house is worth in Greenwich right now? I'm on 6 acres, blah, blah. That's usually was a typical interview. So getting that start was not so easy, but once I get my teeth in something, I can usually chug it faster and harder than the next guy. And so I was able to make good traction pretty fast. And I got a part-time, but still a real official paid gig on the Today Show as a real estate expert as the market crashed, which was fortuitous for me, not for everybody else. But what works better than bad news? Nothing. So I was on every week talking about the bad news and how bad it's been, how bad it's been, bad, 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 bad. And that gave me a voice in the media space, although my expertise, of course, was the one thing I knew, which was real estate.
So one of the main reasons that I started the show, Barbara, was to talk to successful people about the unique aspects of what made them successful and dig into the cool parts of their careers. We conclude the show with a segment from our presenting sponsor, PenX, a Villanova Insurance Partners company. And with real estate, what I'm always fascinated by is home staging. I love home staging.
Yes.
How important is home staging in the sales process?
It is the sales process. Think about it. You know, it used to be an extra. Sellers didn't want to spend the money on it. It's hard to ask someone who has exit in mind. They want to get money out to put money in. That's the problem with selling home staging. But all you have to do is show someone how houses look online, which is now the curb appeal, the front yard of every home in America. People don't start by writing neighborhoods. They start online. Everybody does, right? And how homes present online. All you have to do is show a homeowner what it looks like, staged, not staged, prime, fixed up, not fixed up. And it's almost like someone would have to be a moron not to listen. So good staging can make a difference of not only 10% in the value of the home, I think sometimes 15%, particularly the larger the home and the more expensive the location, people will not forgive you as much if you haven't staged. But staging can make all the difference between selling or not in a soft market. You know, we have a market right now, everything's selling. So people tend to think, well, I don't have to really doll it up. But oh, yes, you do. It makes such a difference with the staging. And these professional people are paid well for a reason. They are your partner in the sales process. They're a salesman. They're not a stager. They're a salesman. And I generally find that people, surprisingly, judge a living room by the size of the area rug, ridiculous as that might sound, not the size of the walls. They judge the upkeep of the house, how the plumbing is based on how neat the closet is. I know it's weird as it is. I know I've shown homes my whole life, right? They think, oh, if it's neat in the closet behind that door, oh, this house must be in great shape. Not necessarily true. Maybe the foundation's falling apart. But staging gives such a great first impression and a lasting one and gets you competitive bids at a higher price than you would have gotten without the staging.
My final question for you, Barbara, you've had so many great investments. And I know
it better be, will you marry me? Because you know why, Arthur? I am looking for a younger man. And a guy like you is kind of what I have in mind. So ask me that last question, but it better be the right one.
Listen, your husband's like a former Navy SEAL and FBI agent. I'm going, I'm going nowhere near you because I might disappear and that could be the end of it. So I like my life.
He doesn't pack a gun and he's old now. So don't worry about old Bill. Put him to the side.
For you, Barbara, obviously you've had so many successful investments, probably some failures, and people have always asked you about your investments. But for you, what has been the most gratifying moment in the journey? Doesn't have to be an investment, but truly gratifying moment.
Oh, easy. The first thing always comes to my mind would be the last thing if you gave me an hour to think about it. 1 year at the Corcoran Group, I had $48,000, I think, in profit. Again, an accident, because I spent every penny a mile before it was coming in on a new office, new computer system, new recruit. I couldn't keep money in my hand, okay? But on that 1 year, I find myself with this money. So my mother and father never had a nice car. You know, we had 10 kids. My dad had his Blue Beauty, which was a Chevrolet, which was new at one point when I was a little kid. But we had it through the next 8 kids after me. And it was beat up. Everybody learned to drive on it, crashed into shit. You know, it was a terrible car. I bought him a brand new Lincoln Continental. He was retired in Florida. And I bought my mother a brand new Pontiac convertible. She had never had a car and I only got a license for 5 years. And I had my uncle Richie and his friend drive it down to Florida, put a bow and leave in their driveway. That was without a doubt, nothing. I could be struck as maybe marry Mark Cuban instead and be a billionaire. But I would never feel as rich and as thankful as that moment. And to hear them call up to them. I mean, I would even like the car. They were nice cars, no doubt. But I wouldn't cry over a car. They just couldn't believe it. And that for me was the best thing that ever happened in my life in terms of sheer satisfaction and joy.
That was awesome. You're amazing, Barbara. Congratulations on everything. You're an example to all entrepreneurs everywhere on the hustle and the grit that it takes to make it. Thank you for a wonderful chat.
My pleasure. Don't forget to promote my podcast now, Business Unusual. Wherever you find your podcast, don't let me down, Arthur.
No, actually, before you go, how much fun are you having with the podcast? Let's plug it quickly.
Hey, it's about time you picked up the hint, a little late on the drawer there. What's great about the podcast is there's only one thing that I do well. I swear to God, maybe a couple of things, but the thing I think I do best is give good advice because I tell it like it is. I don't think there's a single person who calls my 888 Barbara number who thinks to themselves, oh, maybe I shouldn't have called. Everybody's so thankful. I feel like I help people every day of the week on that number and on my podcast. And I choose those questions that I think pertain to the most folks out there, stuff they could use. So I think it's a self-help line, if you want to, having to do with business and actualizing who you want to be. And for those reasons, I think you're crazy if you don't listen to my podcast, and nuts if you don't call 888. And I'm going to check in a half hour, Arthur. And if your proposal isn't on that 888 line, I'm coming after you.
Barbara, will you marry me? 888. Barbara, will you marry me?
Yes, I will. Just let me clean up the little thing with Bill back at the farm.
By the way, are you on that Wheaties box behind you? Is that you?
That was given to me. Yeah, that is me. Let me show it to you. Where is it? Yeah, right. I love this.
I've been looking at that. I'm like, is that Barbara? Oh my God, that's amazing.
You know, the best part about this box, it was given to me as a gift from Sharon Baum, my first heavyweight salesman I recruited out of another firm. And she was so happy to be with me. She made this as a gift. I will never give it away because it's a symbol of the power of hiring the right person. Truly.
I love it.
If you marry me, it's part of the deal.
I love it. And you get to keep it in the future divorce.
Get out of here, Arthur. I have something to do. Bye.
Barbara, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for a wonderful chat. Take
Ciao. Care. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. That was, of course, Barbara Corcoran. Make sure to check out her podcast, Business Unusual with Barbara Corcoran. And of course, Shark Tank, one of the best shows on TV. That thing is a behemoth. Next up, Joy Mangano from the Miracle Mop to hundreds of other inventions. This woman helped build QVC, HSN. She had a movie made about her life called Joy. There's nothing that she hasn't checked off in her lifetime. And now she's checking off being a host of a hit show, America's Big Deal, every single week on USA. This is just a wonderful chat about business, life, taking risks. I love talking to this woman. Here she is, Joy Mangano. All right, we've got an inventive day on The Endless Hustle today as I'm joined by the queen of inventions, the one and only Joy Mangano. Joy, congratulations. You've got this incredible new show. I chatted with Scott Evans a couple of weeks ago, and I'm like, man, I'm enjoying this so much because it's the American dream. There's no other way to put it, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's the epitome of the American dream, right? Because, you know, first of all, you know, America's Big Deal on USA at 9 p.m. on Thursday nights, it's live. So it's authentic, right? And, you know, the network is so brave to do this first time ever shoppable live competition show live, right? Because, you know, people, you know, it was like, well, maybe we should tape it. But the whole idea is that you're watching these pitches live and anything can happen and anything does happen. So it's quite exciting. And, you know, the everybody's talking about how they take the viewer and turn them into a buyer, right? Turn them into a consumer. We just do it naturally, right? Because the viewer becomes the consumer, becomes the buyer. And when these entrepreneurs, you know, present their products, they're amazing products. And the one who sells the most now gets to turn around and face the retail titans. I represent QVC and HSN, then there's Macy's and Lowe's, and we offer and bid for, you know, a six-figure, you know, purchase order that we give them and put them in nationwide retail. That is the American dream. We're taking small businesses and entrepreneurs and lifting them into this, you know, nationwide retail distribution, and we're really holding their hands because, you know, that transition's a tough one. And so I really am very proud, you know, because of what's happened in the last year and a half. Small businesses and entrepreneurs, they've taken a huge hit. They represent over 90% of the firms in this country. That's a lot of people. So I feel that we're really inspiring so many with this show.
You have such an incredible story. And so many people that I'm privileged to speak to, I think, man, this story could be a movie. Yours was made into a movie. When you first saw Joy, and obviously Jennifer Lawrence depicting and the whole loose depiction, but there was so much just knowing your story personally, so much that they got right. What was it like the first time you actually saw the movie and saw it brought to life?
Right. So I'll give you an inside avenue there. It wasn't so loose. But, you know, I have to tell you, obviously, it's a surreal experience. That goes back to, you know, somebody saying I was in Hollywood doing a show and they said, we went out to dinner and they said, one day we're going to write, I'm going to write your movie. And I was like, no, no, no. And then years later, I get a call and he said, I'm in here with this producer and that producer and we're going to make the movie Joy. And so, you know, I still didn't believe it until I sat in 20th Century Fox and I was surrounded by all the executives there and David over everybody and was watching the viewing of the movie. It was almost like an outer body experience, if I could ever experience that, right? Because it was Jennifer Lawrence, so brilliant, everything, you know, and I, as I'm watching it, the only thing after it was over, I thought it was amazing, but I thought, how did I get through all of that? So, I hear that the movie Joy, you know, people watch it every holiday season. It's one of those movies where you can watch and watch again and again. And it's just very inspiring because, you know, we're all the same, but, you know, we're all different, but the same. And everybody has their journey and everybody, you know, tries to get to, you know, various places. We all have family, friends, and so on and so forth. And I think it really, really is a very universal movie in what it says.
Turn back the clock. Here you are essentially hustling, trying to survive as a single mother, but you had always had kind of this invention thing going on in your head. You could see things that were so practical once you invented them, but until they're invented, you're like, who comes up with this shit, right?
Yeah, yep.
When did that begin for you? When did you begin to see the world as an inventor versus as a normal person like the rest of us?
Exactly. That's a great question because I am not normal. And I view the world through product, right? So, and it as a young child, I mean, I was putting together instruments and making a one-man band. I was blowing up my parents' toaster. You know, I was digging up the back lawn and saying I want to plant an organic garden when nobody even cared about organic. And, you know, so it was always like, what's the matter with Joy? You know, and, I loved school. I always was, you know, school came easy to me, but I had no definition to what, you know, what I did. If I played the piano, people would say, oh, she's going to be a concert pianist. You know, that's definable, right? But what I did was not. So until I was 30 something and we had something that was the simple twist of a mop, did I get in my mind the definition of who I was 30 something and legitimize what I did in life all the time. Right. And so, you know, I would sit, out in East Hampton and watch, you know, a gentleman come out of a very expensive bakery struggling with two pies. And, you know, anybody else would say, oh, look at this guy struggling. And I was like, wait, there's got to be a better way. So I invented something called the Piatto Bakery Box, where it had a removable shelf. You could put two pies or 24 cupcakes and it collapsed flat. And that's where my brain goes when I see anything in the world. I'm like, how can I make it better for people? So, you know, it's that's what I do.
By the way, though, that's only half the equation. There's the other half, which we obviously saw in the movie, but also we can see in your real life career with QVC and HSN, which is you've got to be able to create something useful, but then you've got to be just as effective at selling something useful. And that was when the game changed for you with the Miracle Mop. You create the Miracle Mop, it's selling, it's so-so, but then you got up on screen and the magic happened. When did you realize that you creating your brand and you being able to effectively become a salesperson was just as important to the actual product?
Right. So that, in that moment, I think in the movie Joy, David captured that amazingly well, really amazingly well. You know, the only class I ever cut in college was public speaking. So I say God got me back because, you know, here I am now, you know, creating products and I didn't even know about the platform at the time beforehand of QVC. And they said, I demonstrated in flea markets and fairs and boat shows and houseware shows. And so stepping on that stage and having that nationwide exposure to talk about the features and benefits of the first time ever $20 mop, like people would say, who's going to spend $20 on a mop? But it literally created a new category in the stick goods industry, just like a velvety thin hanger created a whole new industry and a billion hangers later across America, you know, and people said, who cares about a hanger? I mean, we throw them out, right? But, you know, it's when you can really be demonstrative. You know, I consider myself one of the first influencers ever and a hustler for sure, but you know, in a good way, right? But you know, when you can talk about the features and benefits of a product and really a product that makes a difference in people's lives, that is a whole new day. And that is directly talking to that consumer. You have them focused on you only as they watch you. And that creates that authenticity, you know, because I go on HSN like 3 hours a pop, 3 hours of talking directly to the consumer. So it's not just about, you know, the product and the features and benefits. It's who's behind it, me, and that authenticness and the history of the product. And today, I think we have the smartest consumer. They have so many places to go to, you know, research, look at product, you know, that this is a different, you know, America's Big Deal is a whole different platform to capture that wide audience and showcase these small businesses and let them talk about the features and benefits in a massive way of their products and take them to a whole other level.
You're a lifelong New Yorker, and I'm actually a Philadelphia transplant who moved to New York a little more than a decade ago. And I always tell people, until you've actually lived and existed in New York, you can never truly understand the impact that city, that universe can make on your life, both personally and professionally. For you, when you think about New York and the influence that it's had on you, what is that influence? And how has it helped shape the direction of your life?
Yeah, that's such a great question, because every pocket of the world, every place in this country is unique and wonderful in its own way. I travel every month, twice a month, back and forth to go to the studios for, you know, 30 years. I land in New York, and everybody like pushing and saying, get, you know, the toughness, the roughness, the honesty, the, you know, the bravery of New Yorkers, you know, is really can't be duplicated anywhere else. It really can't. And as you say, you have to live it and experience it. You know, how New York came back from a devastating, obviously 9/11, you know, how the resilience of New Yorkers, and they will again. They will again, you know, in these times. I feel that it instilled a certain amount of courageousness in me to keep moving forward in life, you know, and not be shy and say, oh, I don't know if I can. It's or laid back in any way. There's like so much energy in New York, right? So I really think that, you know, really kind of helped me keep putting one foot in front of the other when it really looked like it was the end of the road. And that happened to me so many times. I can remember putting my head on a pillow and saying, this is it, Joy. You know, you just can't get through this obstacle. But I'd wake up and I would figure out a way to get through it. And that is what I impart on everybody. You know, if you stop, you have 100% chance of getting nowhere from there. But if you keep going, at least your odds are better. And that's why I say keep going. If you can depend on your own instincts about things, you have a good reality check, keep going. Because now is the time so many people are shifting from one thing and going to, you know what, I'm going to try this passion that I have for something. And we're capturing them on America's Big Deal.
I was talking to Barbara Corcoran last week, and she talked about her New York moment. When she had first moved to New York City, she was walking by this newsstand, and she remembers thinking, wow, like, I'm this like girl from out of town. What am I doing here? She felt like an alien. And then years later, she's like, I'm a New Yorker. And she had this New York moment where she finally realized she was a part of the organism. What was that moment for you? What was your New York moment where you kind of looked around and thought, I'm a part of this organism?
Yeah. Well, so there's many. I mean, there's many. So because I was born in Brooklyn, you know, and I raised, you know, in Long Island and New York City, I've lived. But I was in a big market. And I forgot to get something. So I told the person, I said, oh, my gosh, I forgot to get the bread. I can't remember what. And the person behind me said, she forgot to get the bread. And then the next person said, I'm over here. Can you help her? The whole place just transformed that bread right to my cart, right where I was on at the cash register. And to me, that was an unequivocally a New York moment, because we get involved, we help each other, we're vocal about it. And it was really amazing. It was amazing. So you never feel alone in New York, you know?
So the entrepreneurs that I've had on the show recently, and it's not to name drop, but it's just people that I admire, like you, Damon John, Kevin O'Leary, Marcus Lemonis. I've talked to them all over the last few months. Barbara,
love them.
Obviously.
Love them.
The common thread that I always love hearing about, we always hear about the successes, but the greatest lesson builder that we have is failure. And it's always that ability to overcome consistent failure that helps elevate us to the next level.
Absolutely.
For you, what was a failure that you encountered that was your greatest teacher in helping you elevate to the next level?
Yeah. So depicted a little bit in the movie was, you know, finding out that with my success, having stepped on stage with the my first product, you know, nationwide, the Miracle Mop, was that business people that thought they knew better were literally trying to take that success away by thinking that I didn't know what I was doing and claiming that they, you know, whatever, were in control of my molds and so on and so forth. And that was like, it was like I thought it was going to be the end. But because I have a firm belief that a no is not a no, a failure is not a failure, you have to just grind into that. And I literally discovered so much that I went to California where the molds were. And for the first time ever, I believe in the justice system, a judge never before created a ruling for me to take the molds back to New York out of the state of California and take them physically the next day after a court hearing so that I could begin to build my business. There's a bigger story to that, but it was the justice system. It was the honesty in business that prevailed. And, you know, and anybody else, to think I got on a plane and I was fighting some seriously wealthy people, bad guys, bad people, and little old me won this. And now it changed my entire trajectory of life completely by not taking that failure as the end. When you hear something like that, a no, or you think you failed, my goal is always to turn that no into a yes, figure out what to do to change that trajectory. And most of the time you can. There isn't only one way to do anything in life.
On your TV show, you'd obviously talked about pitching. You're born with that it quality. Like you had it you've probably gone through endless media training and every other training imaginable. But before that, when they threw you on stage at QVC, and HSN, you had that it quality. You were born with it. What happens if someone doesn't happen? What happens if someone is brilliant, but just isn't born with whatever that it quality is? How do they overcome something like that?
So I'm going to let you in on a little secret. I haven't had 1 minute of media training.
Wow.
So not 1 minute. So, as I say, getting on stage for the first time. So what I do is, you know, when you invent or create a product, it's like your children, right? If somebody asks you about your children, you could talk endlessly about them. I mean, you could, but you shouldn't, right? But nonetheless, so when I invent a product, I know every nuance of that. I know every part of that. And so to be able to stand there and talk about that is a very natural and authentic thing for me to do, right? So, and I believe that product is king. So when you are talking about a product, when you're pitching, when you're making a presentation, you want to inform somebody about all the features and benefits, why that product is going to make a difference in your life, why you have to have that, and without it, what your life is going to be like. Every, you know, because I have normally for the last over 20 years, I'm on TV for 3 hours at a time. The opposite of those little Instagram hits of 20 seconds, 3 hours talking about product. There is a lot to say. People, you know, it's not just about the product. It's about, that's why I say I'm one of the first influencers. They're getting to know me. They're getting to know the history of everything. So, you know, it's just something that I think somebody has to have the ability to do. If they really are passionate about their product, it comes out authentically.
How much as a business owner do you bet on the person versus the product? And I know you can't give exact percentages, and I'm sure it's a case by case, but let's say the person is just spectacular, but the product is, do you buy more into, I'm going to invest in the person?
I'm going to say it again. Product is king. I have seen the most prominent, the most influential, the influencers that, you know, talk about a product and sell nothing if the product is not great. It really, we have the smartest consumer in the history of life, of the world, right? We have smart consumers. They can go anywhere and look for product. And I think that at the end of the day, yes, it's nice to know somebody behind that product, right? Where I think celebrity or you know, a known person, you know, gives credibility to a product because you know them, you're familiar with them. But that product at the end of the day has to be something that's going to impact your life, has to be at the right value, has to be the right quality. It's all about the product at the end of the day. Product is king.
You've mentioned the term influencer multiple times now, and it's a term that I feel like has only gained prominence, let's call it, over the last 5 to 10 years, but probably in the last 5 years with the just rise of social media. Are you a fan of today's influencer culture?
Yeah, no, I am. I think that, you know, if it's positivity, I think that's wonderful, right? I'm all about light, bright, positive. And I am. I think, you know, people work really hard at that, right? That, you know, that is something that, you know, it's a way of communicating. And some people, you know, really, they become zoned in on that, and they trust that person. They look for those. We all, you know, all of us, when have you not turned around in life? You know, we all have done it and said, what do you think about this? Or what do you think about this speech? Or what do you think about these clothes or whatever, my haircut? You know, we all, you know, have people that influence our decisions. And I think with positivity, I think it is a beautiful addition to the landscape of what we experience in life.
When you look at so many of the things that you've invented, was there one that you had an idea for, but that didn't come to fruition for whatever reason, that you think back and you think, if this would have come to fruition, it would have been the next greatest thing?
Yeah, I can't tell you about this. I wish I could, but I will tell you, going back, it's a true story. That because I love, love, love our furry friends. I'm a dog lover forever. I mean, so passionately. And true story, I thought I was going to be a veterinarian. So I graduated high school a year early. I loved learning. So I was just like, you know, crazy honor student. Anyway, I said, I'm going to work in an animal hospital before I go to college. And I saw that at that time, so many dogs and cats were hit by cars at night. That's what, you know, all the surgeries were for. And I said, what do they have all the time that they're wearing, which was a flea collar in those days. And I said, I'm going to invent the first fluorescent flea collar. And I had a group of veterinarians together. I was 16 years old. I never followed through with it. And a year later, Hearts Mountain Pet Company came out with the first ever fluorescent flea collar. So they say, and I mean, my life would have been very different if I had followed through with it. And I was, you know, old enough. We just recently had on America's Big Deal, a 19-year-old young man who won on America's Big Deal with an invention of his. And he started when he was 13. So it's amazing. So there, you know, great ideas. I say to everybody, if you trust your instincts, follow through with it, because you will get somewhere.
One of the things we also see in joy, and obviously we've seen throughout the world, we're now finally seeing more of an evolution of opportunities for women. But back when you were first starting out, and we see this in the movie, it wasn't so easy to be a woman in business. What was it really like back then? How hard was it to break through as a woman?
Yeah. So the real honest answer, it was really hard. It was, I can't remember a meeting that I was in where I wasn't the only female in the room. And I really feel like you're out of that, out of a circle, so to speak, is the only way to kind of describe it. So very quickly, I said, I'm paying no attention to that. I deserve a seat at the table if, you know, I'm running a business and blah, 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 wherever it was. I absolutely put that out of my mind, and I just functioned as any New Yorker would, you know, in the brave, courageous way. And I paid no attention to it at all. And I'm an advocate for women, but I'm an advocate for everybody. I believe if you've earned a seat at the table, so to speak, you deserve to be there no matter who you are, you know. And yes, it was hard for women, you know, and I've seen that it's been an amazing transition. And I have to tell you, quite honestly, I think we add a lot to the business world, to the world that I'm in. You know, I come at things from a different perspective. There used to be, you know, I used to hear all the time, well, it's business, you know, and like your principles in your life are different from your business principles. And I very quickly, you know, made it clear that my principles in my life are exactly the same as they are in business. And I think that's permeating, you know, I'm not going to say thanks to women, but I do think it's just in general, a more educated humanity, that it's not, you know, you have a certain amount of kinds of guidelines at home and you do things differently because it's business. And, you know, I think that's changed dramatically. And first, it was my philosophy since day one, actually.
Joy, this has been such a wonderful chat. Congratulations, the new show, and it's a wonderful show, America's Big Deal on USA. You guys are doing a fantastic job, and I love the opportunities you guys are giving to people. Congratulations on everything.
Thank you so much, Arthur. Thank you very much.
Enjoy your day. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, that was Joy Mangano. Make sure to check out America's Big Deal every single week on USA. And finally, we're finishing it up with one of the biggest reality stars on television, a Bravo celebrity. She's killing it on two shows, not one, but two, Summer House and now Winter House. Here she is, Lindsay Hubbard. All right, we got a great day on The Endless Hustle as I'm joined by, I want to call you an A-list reality star at this point, Lindsay Hubbard, because I feel like between Summer House and Winter House, I can't go anywhere in New York without people just loving you guys. So especially in this city, just you guys have become iconic. It's crazy, right?
Wow, that is quite the title. A-list reality star, something I did not grow up thinking was going to be a part of my resume.
I know, right? You're like, oh, I'm going to go to school for accounting or like
public
economics.
Right.
Now it's like, by the way, I'm an A-list reality star.
Wow. Wow. I feel that's such a compliment. Thank you.
Well, listen, Summer House has just become iconic, especially in these parts. Like I live in the West Village. you guys are just like taking over the city. Between, I was talking to Craig Conover about this. Like, I discovered Dumois like a month ago. So every Sunday, I somehow, when I'm hungover in bed, I'm like reading where everybody is. And you guys get more like write-ups on Dumois than anybody. And I'm like, holy shit, this is crazy how much like people are obsessed.
I know. Well, I mean, I think New York's a little bit of a different culture. We walk around, you know, that's what we do in New York. You know, whether it's like going to the grocery store or running some sort of errand or going to dinner, we're always like on the streets walking to get there. So we get caught a lot more than maybe in other cities where people are in their cars or live in the suburbs.
Do you enjoy that? Do you enjoy, like, if you're saying something to a friend that there could be someone literally eavesdropping two people away and you're like, shit, I can't believe people are actually listening in on my conversations?
Yeah, it's definitely a weird feeling. I mean, I enjoy it when I'm like, you know, walking down the street and they're like, Summer House or, you know, Lynn's, whatever. And I'm like, hey, but yeah, no, it's definitely terrifying. We've had to, you know, kind of cater our conversations in public, you know, to be a little bit more private or not have as loud of voices as we normally would. Because, you know, I remember there was like one time I was over summer, I was on the train. I was going to, I think, surprise Carl at a Loverboy event in White Plains. And I was talking to Danielle about some guy I had, you know, gone on a date with, and how he was like, no, like, I don't, you're too public for me. I can't handle it. And, you know, he was upset that fans were coming up to me when I was with him. And whoever was eavesdropping on my conversation completely twisted it around that Lindsay feels this way. And so sometimes with Dumois, I have to like clear it up myself. I'm like, no, that's not how this went down. I was talking about a guy who rejected me and he felt that way, not me.
I just discovered Dumois. I grew up during the Page Six. Like, Page Six is the holy Bible of gossip. I'm 43. I've been in New York for 11 years. Like, so Page Six was, being in entertainment for the last decade, was my daily read. And then someone turned me on to Dumois and I'm like, what is Dumois? So I was like at American Bar in the West Village. And I'm literally on a Sunday, like strolling Dumois. And I'm like, this is crazy. They have like people writing in left and right. Like,
yeah, items and sightings. It's like a fan generated paparazzi, basically. And like, you know, it's very interesting because not everyone is a credible source. Whereas like Page Six, they, you know, do fact checking and, you know, have to confirm from like multiple sources in order to write something. So it is a very interesting dynamic, but it's fine, whatever.
So let's turn back the clock. You obviously have just been very successful with PR, marketing, you have your own agency. How does Summer House happen? How does that whole thing begin for you?
Well, I think they met Kyle first, and then Kyle was like, you should meet my group of friends. And it was September of 2015, was like kind of our heyday of New York City, my group of friends. And we rolled deep, like hundreds of friends, obviously extended and different, you know, peripheral groups. But yeah, Kyle was like, hey, we're throwing this party. It was after summer, called Back on Campus. Why don't you guys come to this party and meet all of our friends? So slowly but surely, they just started picking us, you know, out one by one and interviewing us. And they're like, you have what it takes, Lindsay. We're putting you on this. And I was like, okay, sure. Like, we go to the Hamptons every summer anyways. Let's just invite the cameras and see what happens. And at that point in time, we had no idea. We didn't know how long this thing was going to last. It could have been a one and done season for all we knew. We had no clue that it would go this long and, you know, that we'd still be here.
Were you nervous when the cameras were going to be on? You were like, shit, I have to actually like be on somewhat decent behavior.
I mean, the nervousness never really goes away. I mean, like at some point you just like, you know, we forget that the cameras are there, but you know, every first weekend or every first, you know, time filming for that season, like you still have the butterflies. They just don't ever go away. And then you're just like, oh, whatever, you know, like we're so lucky. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize this, but our production, our producers, and our crew have been with us for years. And that's pretty much unheard of in reality TV. You know, typically you get different producers each season, or camera guys, sound guys, lighting, and our entire crew just pushes and like asks to come back to our show year after year. So we've become friends with them. And, you know, it's almost just like, you know, the guy behind the camera has been in my life for the last 5 years. It's almost just like, oh, that's just another friend in the room.
Yeah, the guy behind the camera, they're probably like, hey, we're going to send you to Alaska for Gold Rush. He's like, yeah, no, I think I'll do Montauk again. I'm good.
Yeah. Well, and it's, if you can get the guy behind the camera to laugh, then you know you just said something funny. You're just like, okay, I got him to laugh. This must be good.
I always tell people there is nothing like New York. The electricity, the innovation, the eccentricities, it really molds who you are as a person. I'm a Philly boy and I moved here 11 years ago. And now I consider myself a New Yorker. It totally changed me. For you, for someone who was raised in New York and has now built a really cool life for yourself in New York, how has New York impacted your life and the direction of your life?
Wow. I mean, listen, New York is just such a special city. Like you said, the electricity, the energy. You wake up and there are people all over the streets. So you're like, okay, I need to be productive. I need to do stuff. Like you just like you learn how to hustle and motivate and push yourself because everyone else around you is doing that. So, I mean, I think that that hustle translates not only in you know, a career or work, but in every other direction of your life. You know, you just start hustling to you know, keep the pace along with everyone else.
I was talking to Barbara Corcoran about what I call her New York moment. And it was a moment where she kind of looked around and it was almost this Dorothy in Wonderland moment where it's like, there's no other place in the world that I could be experiencing what I'm experiencing right now. For you, what was your New York moment? What was the moment where you're like, I'm a New Yorker, this is unreal?
It was probably when I moved back to New York. So I graduated college, moved to New York in 2008. And then after a year, I wound up in LA for 3.5 years. And then I moved back at the end of 2012. And I think it was then, because I just got back in this groove, you know, with new clients. And, I was like basically representing like all the hospitality groups in New York. And, you know, it was so much fun, being able to like work in the restaurant bar business, and entertain people, everywhere we went. So yeah, it was probably 2012, 2013 that I was like, I'm in it.
Was the acclimation immediate? So once you had left and then come back, did you feel like a foreigner?
No, I kind of got adopted by a group of friends that were here. You know, I met them through my girlfriends, and then slowly but surely got adopted into this huge group of friends. So I didn't feel like I never really had the opportunity to feel like a foreigner because I just like kind of picked right up where I left off.
All right. So I want to talk about Winterhouse. Obviously this thing has been awesome. I love kind of the Marvel universe, the Avengers kind of mix and match of all these great casts. What was it like? Obviously, you know, your cast, but what was it like incorporating all the other different elements?
Oh, with the snow?
And just the different cast members from different shows.
Oh, different cast members. I mean, you know, I've known Austin and Craig for years. You know, I think it's so interesting because like we have different formats of shows. Winterhouse is more along the lines of a summer house type of style, whereas Southern Charm down in Charleston, they don't live together in a house and film. So I think it was interesting watching them adjust to our format of filming. And then the new people, I mean, it was a little bit of a strange feeling going into Winterhouse, not having, you know, Carl and Danielle, for example, my best friends, and then not knowing who these four new people are. And then also like being in the element of snow, like I grew up in Florida, so I'm not, you know, very experienced in the sports that require me to attach something to my feet. All the sports I played were on land and I played every single one of them my entire life. So yeah, it was a little intimidating, like, oh no, I'm gonna go fall down a mountain and run into a tree and hope not to die. So that was different.
Yeah, the Southern Charm crew is probably like, I have to share a house with everybody. What right. the fuck is happening here?
Yeah.
Like we're used to like our mini mansions down in Charleston. What are we dealing with here?
Yeah. I remember like Austin throughout filming, he was just like, Linz, how do you guys do this year after year? And I'm like, welcome. Welcome to having a camera in the corner of your room that's rolling 24/7.
I would be so self-conscious. Like I remember Jersey Shore was like my generation of like the first big kind of throw them in a house. I mean, you had Big Brother and all that other stuff, but.
Well, and Real World.
And Real World too. Yeah, you know what? You're right. I was never an MTV kid growing up, believe it or not. Jersey Shore was probably like, I did the music videos, but then the first reality show that I can remember watching was probably Jersey Shore on MTV. And like everybody else, I just got hooked on that shit. I was like, this is crack. These people are amazing. But I just remember thinking, man, like you're having sex with somebody and there's literally like a camera and watching your grinding movements. I'm like, this is crazy.
That is probably year after year, the one part of me that I'm like, oh no, oh no. I mean, I literally had to tell my dad not. I was like, you're not allowed to watch this show anymore, Dad. He told me it was the funniest thing. I think it was season 4. And it was the first episode. And he goes, Linz, within the first 5 minutes, you're taking your top off and getting in the hot tub with Carl. And he was like, couldn't turn it off fast enough on his remote. And I was like, good. Now you learned your lesson. Don't watch the show, Dad.
He's like, what did I do? I can't believe this is happening.
Yeah. He was like, I was like, yeah, please. Like, I would like for you to preserve your mental note in your head of me as your baby girl, not as watching me, you know, hook up with some guy.
He like looks over at your mom. He's like, what have we done? What have we done?
Now they're just like, well, that's my daughter.
Yeah, they're like, go for it, Linz. Yeah. Just do it. Just do it, as Nike would say. How has this changed your life, by the way? Like when you look back, you've now had multiple years of this. If you were to go back in time and tell young pre-reality show Lindsay Hubbard what to expect and what she would experience, what would those words be?
I mean, I don't think you can expect anything. No one can really prepare you for what is to come. I remember we were asking the Vanderpump cast, because we had filmed with them season 1. We were just like, what is gonna happen? And they give you a little advice, but like, again, you just like, you don't know. I mean, I never expected it to still be on TV. Like, I don't know. Like you just, it's really hard to explain what to expect. I mean, the way that the show has blown up has been incredible. And I think it was a slow ramp up period. You know, I think we started hitting our stride as a cast and production on season 4. And then, you know, obviously the pandemic helped because a lot of people were at home trying to discover new shows to watch. And then, you know, we got a lot of new eyeballs on us because of that. And then people just like fell in love with our antics. And I think it's like so fun because, you know, if you know the New York City culture, you know that this is what we do. We go to the Hamptons every single weekend. And now with Winterhouse having a second show, I think is people are loving Winterhouse. And it's just like watching a bunch of drunk people act, you know, like fools and get rejected and like hook up with each other is just like fun television.
By the way, when they're always writing, obviously you and the Kyle thing has been like Page Six, Dumois and all that shit. When they're writing stuff, but you know, it's not true. And I know you mentioned you've gone to Dumois and kind of refuted stuff, but do you kind of just laugh about it? Like, are you like, these people have no fucking idea?
Yeah, of course. I mean, at one point it was like, no, everyone's like, wait, so Lindsay was with Austin, but then a day later I was with Luke, and then a day later I'm walking down the street with Carl. Like, it's just like, it's really funny. I'm like, wow, they are just really trying to figure out who I'm dating all the time. It's just the funniest thing to me, because I'm like, all of a sudden I'm dating everyone. And I'm like, do they honestly think I have this much time to date all of these men? I mean, props to me if they think I have that much time on my hands.
I mean, listen, props to you if all the guys on multiple shows want you, right? Like, that's it's desirable, right?
I mean, listen, I'm kind of like, I grew up as a tomboy. I grew up with the boys. And I have that like bro side to me, where I can kick back and drink Bud Heavies with Luke and, you know, go to sporting events and be really into it. But then I also have this like, you know, more of a girly side to me. So I mean, it is fun. I tend to hang with the boys a lot because they're, you know, less dramatic. And then subsequently I wind up having to defend them all the time. And I'm like, oh gosh. Like, here I am out there, like doing the good deed of like always trying to defend the boys when they're messing up with all the girls. I'm like, oh gosh, guys, get it together.
By the way, what was the first time you remember that you were recognized because of Summer House? Like, what was the first fan out moment?
So it was season one had just aired. I think it was January of 2017. And Everett, I was dating Everett at the time. And for Valentine's Day, we had gone to Broadway. We went to go see something on Broadway. And this woman comes up to me and she's like, oh my God, Lindsay, you're from Summer House. And we'd only been on TV for a month. It only been airing for a month. And I meet her and her husband, and they're like, you have to meet our daughter. She, you know, is in college right now. We would love for her to intern for you. She's a public relations major. And so the dad had wound up Facebooking me. And for whatever reason, I accepted. And for the next year, he was like, can you please hire my daughter as your intern? And then the next year, okay, my daughter is graduating. Can you please hire her? So finally, I think it was like season three, I was like, Ira, send me your daughter's resume. I need to hire, a coordinator. And I wound up hiring her. And now, you know, she was my assistant for the last, I guess, 3 years. And she's like a little sister to me. So that was, I wound up working out there, and her parents, I'm still really close with them, and we hang out with them all the time. They live in Brooklyn.
God bless parents. You. That could have gone sideways. That's like so stalkery and creepy, but meanwhile, it worked out.
It really worked out. And she was the best, little sister assistant I could have ever asked for.
Yo, you're awesome. This was so much fun. Congratulations, Summer House, Winter House, all the stuff you're doing. You've got such a magnetic personality. So
thank you.
It's so fun to talk. While you're crushing it on TV.
And maybe you should come to the hockey game with us in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Be like, hey, just sitting right in the middle. Like, hey, guys.
Just like hanging out with all the parents.
You're awesome. Thanks for a fun chat, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
All right, that was Lindsay Hubbard. Make sure to check out Winter House and Summer House on Bravo. Thanks for a fabulous chat, Lindsay. That is it for another great episode, another triple header, packed episode of Bro Bible's Endless Hustle. Make sure to subscribe, rate, show us the love. Follow me on social media. I'm at It's Me, Arthur Cade on Instagram, at Arthur Cade on Twitter. Our Endless Hustle accounts are at @endless_hustle on Twitter, at Endless Hustle Pod on Instagram. We're back on Thursday with another loaded triple header. We've got Steve Sharippa, country music superstars Old Dominion, and Dolph Lundgren and Scott Adkins talking all about their new movie. Yes, that Dolph Lundgren. Drago's in the house. We'll see y'all on Thursday. Keep endlessly hustling.